dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In recent days, there has been a major fight in that war, in my view. The issue is the question of whether or not the United States will surrender what I think of as really our internet to some sort of global management scheme and the predations, presumably thereby, of some rather bad actors operating on the international scene these days, if not immediately, certainly in due course. A man who knows an enormous amount about the internet, about its functions, about particularly what's at issue at the moment with this transfer of the so-called naming and numbering authority to a multinational group called ICANN, is our first guest. He is Michael A. Daniels, truly one of the pioneers in the internet, the former CEO and chairman of Network Solutions, also of Mobile 365. He's been very active for decades in the public and private sectors' involvement in the internet, currently serves on 6 boards, and has been the co-author of an important book touching on so many of these issues, Names, Numbers, and Network Solutions, the Monetization of the Internet. Mike Daniels, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is a great privilege to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Frank, great to be with you and your listeners this morning. I appreciate being on.
Well, listen, I wanted to talk with you for a while about what has been underway with respect to initiative by President Obama, as I say, to transfer an important, well, I guess the last remaining function that the United States government oversees. Would you just describe what's going on and give us a sense of the stakes as you see them?
Sure, Frank. What we're dealing with is the United States government under a contractual agreement through the U.S. Department of Commerce since 1998 has had final legal authority over what we call the domain name system, which is basically a function where if you type in, for instance, www.google.com, the technical part of that is it has to match with an underlying IP address that is in something called the Whois database. That was maintained by the company I acquired originally in 1995. Today, that function is at VeriSign. They bought us in 2000. So it's not so simple how it works, but if this doesn't work correctly, no one in the world can get on the internet. And the control of this is of vital importance to today's economy, where we're running trillions of dollars of e-commerce all over the internet and all from all parts of the world, and also from the U.S. national security standpoint. So the United States government in the Obama administration made a decision several years ago to transition this final U.S. control point to ICANN, which is an international organization which we actually helped establish with the U.S. government in the late 1990s. So once October 1 is the drop-dead date, and it appears that there are a number of people who want to see this go through in the administration. So once that happens, Frank, we don't have any more certainty about what will go on in the future. And if anyone anywhere tells you that they know exactly that this function will continue without politics, without foreign governments attempting to do no telling what over time, won't happen tomorrow, might happen a year or 2 years or 3 years from now, don't believe them, because I have seen from operating that system for 5 years from 1995 to 2000 that politics can interfere. And we even in our book, Names, Numbers, and Network Solutions that you mentioned, talk about an instance while we had control of that system under authority of the United States government where someone redirected away from Network Solutions the ACE server, which controls the downloading of all internet names and numbers every day across the globe, redirected it, and people in a large part of the globe for a short period were not able to use the internet. So there are a lot of people who don't even know that history, and that's a fact that this happened. And the United States government, because it had the contractual agreement, sent federal marshals, Frank, sent federal marshals in the late 1990s to the University of Southern California to make sure that those servers around the world were redirected back to us in Herndon, Virginia. So, you know, this type of thing can happen. And again, we've had certainty all of these years because of this final legal point of control that the Obama administration is going to turn over to ICANN on October 1.
Mike Daniels, let me ask you, there's so much there that I want to unpack, but in particular, there was a letter that I have the feeling provided political cover to members of Congress who were asked to prohibit this transfer. It came from a group of your peers, really, in the technology business. Technology CEO Council was the umbrella under which they sent this letter. And I just want to read this one passage to you in light of what you just said, Mike. And it's, quote, "Placing stewardship of these technical but important functions beyond the control of any one government or group of governments will best secure the principles of internet freedom and depoliticization of technology," unquote. What would you say to the signers of this letter?
Well, what I'd say is that phrase is open to enormous debate and has been debated inside the technical and business community for many years, Frank. This is a debate that goes back 20 years to the late 90s when the internet started to become commercialized and millions and millions of people started to use it. So that's a completely open to debate. That statement does not ring true to me, having 40 years of experience in the tech business and actually having run the company where I saw the day-to-day workings of how this has to function. What I would say is that phrase has nothing centrally to do with the problem. It's a subterfuge. The problem is the internet has functioned perfectly well, bringing on billions of people and running trillions of dollars worth of commerce to help everybody in the world as a U.S. invention since the late 1990s. The issue is a technical issue. It's not a political issue so much in my mind. The internet relies on two things, Frank, for its daily operation for all the people of the world and the United States. One is we have to have a methodical technical system of stability, and there has to be a final point of legal control. And once you remove this, which is what is going to happen the 1st of October, you have removed the one thing every corporate business person depends on using the internet, which is certainty and stability. If anyone tells you, they can assure you that certainty and stability, once this provision is removed with the backing of the United States government, don't believe them because they do not know that.
You were among the signatories of a very important letter on the sort of security aspects of this. And you, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were the people to whom that letter was sent. They have not seemingly responded. But would you just share with us why you are concerned as a professional about what the implications might be for our national homeland and cybersecurity?
My concern, Frank, and as one of the signatories of the letter, which I felt it was very important for us to send to the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, is that more and more of the United States national security apparatus not only uses the internet for communication, but the internet is being hooked up, as we all know, where we're trying to connect every type of car, TV set, refrigerator, everything in the world to the internet. And we've got an enormous number of Department of Defense and national security assets now connected to the internet that's in daily use.
Including the electric grid. And Mike, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to drill down on that particular issue with you and the dangers that might be associated with the internet really coming under the influence of malign forces. More right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realized their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting with Michael A. Daniels. He was the chairman and CEO of Network Solutions. He is also the author of an important book about the Internet, Names, Numbers, and Network Solutions, the monetization of the Internet. And names, of course, and numbers are precisely what we're talking about. The transfer of the authority to oversee and maintain quality control of those functions is now perilously close to being given away. And Michael, you were talking about the implications of the Internet of Things now involving things like our electric grid, the most critical of critical infrastructures. Should we find the Internet becoming less stable, less reliable than it's been, what might the repercussions be for things that power everything we rely upon for life, in fact?
It's a critical problem for the country, Frank, to start with. And over the last 2 years in our American Enterprise Institute project on global Internet strategy, we've interviewed several hundred of leading experts, former government officials, current government officials, private sector, technology people. One of the areas we focused on is the electric grid and the electric industry. And we've talked with key people in that industry who have been considerably concerned about the constant probing of the electric grid in the United States of America by foreign nations and all kinds of organizations who ping not only every corporation system and your own individual systems if you're a user of the internet, but the problem of potential cyber attack on our electric grid and the potential to shut parts of that down or to disrupt commerce as a result of that. So this is a real problem, just like the probing of our financial infrastructure, just like the probing of our water systems. In a time of national crisis, or some type of major cyber attack on this country, Frank, if people who tend to poo-poo that idea, they're just not realistic in my mind, because this is a form of warfare that people are just now starting to understand, and we've seen it exhibited by the Russians in Eastern Europe.
Let me turn to one other piece of this. We have been, as I say, assured by others in the internet business that notably this technology CEO council, that, you know, this is actually a necessary step. I haven't actually heard a good explanation for why we should do this. Have you? Is there really any compelling reason that the proponents are offering, Mike Daniels?
Frank, this has, again, been discussed for many years. It's been an evolutionary process with ICANN and endless internet groups and bodies. And I personally remain to be convinced of why you would ever transfer this final control, where we've had stability and everything has worked for now for at least 25 years of the commercialization of the internet. The internet started back in 1962, as you know, with funding from the Advanced Research Projects Agency. No one's been able to give me, right, Defense Department, no one's been able to give me a realistic assurance of why we would have any certainty in turning this over. And I think an important historical note is, when I was running Network Solutions, Frank, from 1995 to 2000, until we sold it to VeriSign at the height of the dot-com boom, the Chinese came to see me a number of times. They were sent to me by the United States government. I met with officials from the United Nations and the ITU going back now 20 years, Frank. And even in those days, the early days of the commercialization of the internet, the Chinese were asking the question, well, why does the United States control .cn, which is the domain name for China, the country code? UN officials were saying, why does the U.S. control this? It should be shifted to us or the ITU. This has been a constant drumbeat, and I'm convinced that once the Snowden episode happened, Edward Snowden, the infamous traitor who turned over our NSA secrets to the Russians and a large part of the world, that the current administration simply made the decision that there was too much heat politically, internationally, and they caved on this issue. Now, why you would do that, I still have no understanding, no rational or logic reason you would do that. Remember that Bill Clinton's administration, who I negotiated the original agreement with in the late 1990s, was totally opposed to turning over this ultimate control.
Let me ask you about two quick things, if I could, Mike. One is the appearance that a lot of people in esteemed positions such as you've held regard themselves not so much as American citizens or certainly running American companies, but as citizens of the world or multinational corporations. I wonder whether that's having a bearing upon this, and secondly, whether there's a possibility that we might at some point have to have a new U.S. internet, kind of like what the Chinese have built.
Well, I think the answer to your question, Frank, is I think people in American business, and I've been a global business leader for many years and run global companies, you always are very sensitive. You have to be as flexible as possible dealing in the international global world. So we all realize that. That's just part of what we do in business. On the other hand, I think it's very important that American business leaders need to understand we've moved into a digital world. And many people still don't understand that, Frank. They don't understand the implications of that. I see that in the United States government in many places today. They still are lagging years behind the problems we've got with things like we're talking about here with the internet. Business leaders need to understand that the central core of the United States, and they wouldn't have a business unless we have national security here. So I'm a strong believer in United States national security, the protection of our country, and, you know, first and foremost, I think you can be a global business person, but global business people come from every country, and, you know, you have to be concerned about your particular country and trying to help the country secure itself and secure its digital networks. So that would be number one, and I I'd say number two, I just think that we need to come to a realization that is slowly dawning on lots of people in corporate America that this is the biggest problem we face. And if you don't get on board with trying to cooperate with the things that need to be done, and you certainly have to be careful about that legally, regulatorily, et cetera. But you need to understand we're living in a different age. And when you think of the hundreds of billions of dollars of intellectual property, Frank, that have been stolen out of our major U.S. corporations, you need to get your head on right, because we are being picked apart piece by piece by our adversaries.
So might this translate into ultimately a different kind of internet in which there are safeguards built in that don't exist at the moment?
I think it does, Frank. I think a lot of us believe that have been in this internet business and the tech industry for a long time. We're already seeing people take enormous amounts of valuable information offline, Frank. We are seeing country after country close down the internet. China, Russia, Iran. This is growing by the day. Freedom House has a great report for your listeners that talks about basically more and more countries are cutting off access because they don't want this flow of information. So I think we will see a different type of internet. I think you will see things change dramatically as people have to come to the point where they protect themselves and their sensitive information.
Well, you will be at the leading edge of all of that, I'm quite sure, and we can't tell you how much we appreciate your leadership in the evolution of the internet to date, and particularly in this important battle over the future of our internet. Mike Daniels, thank you so much for your time today and your important work, Names, Numbers, and Network Solutions, the monetization of the internet. Keep it up. Come back to us, I hope, very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Representative Mike Kelly about all of this. He is an opponent of this transfer. Ask him about where things stand. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Congress has just showed why so many Americans are sick of their politicians and ready to throw the bums out. The Senate and House leadership have agreed to President Obama's surrender of your internet to freedom's enemies. The deed was done yesterday when Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pushed through the Senate a funding bill without a prohibition on the internet giveaway. The House is expected to rubber stamp it today. Political cover came from something called the Technology CEO Council. This group of interested parties whose lobbyists give generously to politicians' campaigns blithely assured Congress, quote, placing stewardship of these technical but important functions beyond the control of any one government or group of governments will best secure the principles of internet freedom and depoliticization of technology, unquote. Shame on the CEOs for disseminating such transnationalist rubbish, and the Congress for swallowing it. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a member of Congress who understands the kinds of things we were just talking about with Mike Daniels and has been working very hard for some 3 years to try to stave off this idea of surrendering our internet. He is Representative Mike Kelly. He represents the people of part of my home state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the 3rd District specifically, serving on the House Ways and Means Committee. And playing an important role on a whole host of issues, and we're delighted to have a chance to catch up with him on several of them, including this internet business. Congressman Kelly, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Well, Frank, thanks so much. Nice to talk to another Keystoner.
Well, thank you. Last night, apparently, the House jammed through this continuing resolution, as it's called. This evidently did allow the transfer of this important asset to probably unfriendly hands. Give us a sense of what you think is likely to flow from that decision.
Well, you know, Frank, and early on, and about 3 years ago, we learned the president's intention was to turn away from America's ability on something, and it created, by the way, the internet is something that's an American invention. That's an American piece that really has made it wonderful for people around the world to communicate with each other. But when it comes to the names and numbers that are assigned, we had an oversight responsibility, and we could look and see who it was that was trying to get into these different areas, like .mil and .gov. Those are exclusively properties of the United States of America. But whenever you turn over the oversight of who gets that, all of a sudden the names and the numbers start to get blurred, and you have different players out there, some of them very irresponsible, and some of them looking at the vacuum of leadership, again, by the United States leaving the field and saying, I think it's better if the world joins in this, and say, yeah, but you know, when you say that, Mr. President, first of all, you don't have the authority to give up something that's American property, and secondly, you're inviting a lot of bad actors onto the field to make decisions on how the Internet should go and the names and the numbers, the assignment of the names and numbers, and that really opens up a whole different Pandora's box, and once that's open and gone, it's gone. We can't get it back. We can't have the oversight that we need to make sure that the Internet stays free, and that's the main concern I have. This is going to turn into something that we're going to look back on not years from now, but very soon, and say, oh, my God, what did we allow to have happen on our watch? And it's going to be, you turned over a basic responsibility and oversight that we believe the United States of America needed to stay involved with and have oversight over to make sure that it stayed open for the world and to provide freedom to people all over the world. The Arab Spring would not have happened without the Internet. All these things could be hammered down, closed down, shut down for freedom-loving people around the world. That's the key to it. Now, the president says, no. We're not really that exceptional. Let's just turn it over to a group of stakeholders, what he calls stakeholders. These are different countries. I don't want to have China and Russia involved in who gets these names and numbers and blurring the whole ability of us to have the independence that we need to have.
Hey, you know, Mike, one of the things that we were able to help produce in the past couple of days, unfortunately without significant effect, was a letter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense warning about the security implications of this as well. And that just fits right in with what you're saying. This is lunacy and really irresponsible on both the executive branch and legislative branch's part, I'm afraid, to transfer this important technology and capabilities. So thank you for your efforts to stand athwart it. Let me turn to one thing that you've done, which I think is actually quite important and came out right, and that is that the Congress has just overridden the president's veto for the first time in this presidency, this time involving a piece of legislation I know you've also been very engaged on, the Saudi involvement in 9/11. Would you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Of course, the president's view was that the American families who had people they had lost, and these are things, terrorist activities that have taken place on American soil, for crying out loud. And we know who sponsored them, and we know that these people had the right. It's about justice being delivered to the families of the victims of 9/11 and other atrocities and terrorist activities that take place in our country. They have the ability now to sue to make sure that justice does follow that. And I think that when you look at things that you and I would look at and most of our listeners would look at and say, wait a minute, you mean we actually were going to be prevented from doing that? And say, yes, well, now that's changed because with JASTA, that's the title of the law, that's the justice against the terrorist states, okay, and the right to sue. American people, American families who have been victims, that have lost family members, now have the right to sue those who provided the revenue that was necessary to perform these acts. Now, the president says, no, we shouldn't do that. But overwhelmingly, in the House of Representatives, the People's House, Republicans and Democrats came together and said, no, they should have the right to do this. The Senate said the same thing. We sent it down to the president. He said, look, I told you not to send it to me because I'm going to veto it because you doggone people are too stupid to understand the implications of this, and I'm vetoing it. The House, the People's House, and the Senate got together again and overwhelmingly, and I mean in great numbers, showed up to negate the president's veto and put this into law. That is a stunning victory. It is an historic victory, and the first time in the seven plus years that this president's veto has been overridden by the People's House and by the Senate. The people in Congress who represent all those folks back home who can't come here and speak for themselves, we spoke for them. We spoke loud and clear. It was historic, and it was the right thing to do.
I understand that there was a waiver inserted into it by Chuck Schumer that might offset the effect of it, unfortunately. Is that your understanding, Congressman Mike Kelly?
I know the president was making every effort possible to get senators to back away from it, and I think the first call he probably makes is to Chuck Schumer or to Harry Reid and say, hey, you know what? We have to stop this. You have to do this. You know, the vote in the Senate was 97 to one. And I think Harry Reid was the only one that voted against it. So apparently the president's call to Schumer didn't work. And maybe Schumer thinks he gets a free pass because he threw this waiver in to somehow throw a cookie down to the White House and say, "No, Mr. President, you know, I had to vote this way because, you know, we got an important election coming up. Now, sir, you're going to go off and play golf for the rest of your life and continue to collect big sums of money. But I've got to make sure that we get reelected and all these other little things that make sense to these folks. And what's in their best interest, but not in the best interest of the people who sent them the representatives." So I understand Schumer. I think anybody that doesn't understand Schumer has just not been paying attention. And it does, if you don't understand who Harry Reid is, then, you know, my God, are you leaving yourself open for a sucker punch? So, look, we did what was right.
I'm hoping that it will actually translate into accountability for the Saudis, and there's no doubt in my mind that they were up to their keisters in this attack on the United States. Let me ask you lastly, if I may, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania, you are, as I mentioned, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee. I know you're following closely this, increasing debate, I guess you'd say now, involving both the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates about the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's talk that this will be something that, again, will be jammed through the Congress in the upcoming lame duck session, irrespective of which of these guys who say they, guys and gal, who say they oppose this treaty. What do you think of the prospects for that?
Well, listen, I think there is a great need, first of all, and the effort should be that we have to have trade agreements. But in this piece, as much as there's going to be an effort to move it forward, Frank, I think it would be foolish, and this is with, I know that Ambassador Froman tried to do everything he could to get a good trade agreement. There's too many flaws in it right now for, I think, to go forward. In a lame duck, I don't think this has a snowball's chance in heck of getting through. When you have the two candidates, both on the Republican side and the Democrat side, speaking out long and loud about what they don't like about TPP, and I think the situation, the temperature of the country is right now, that's not something they'd be in favor of. I am in favor of trade agreements as long as they are fair. I would say this. For the United States, the biggest market in the world, not to be able to forge a deal or an agreement that protects the interests of American workers, then there's something wrong. We need to send better people to negotiate trade. And I'm not, again, this is not a shot at Ambassador Froman. He's trying to answer a lot of questions and do a lot of things. But I will say this. If it doesn't work for us, if it's not about jobs, and more jobs for American workers, then that's something we need to take a look at and say, my God, who did we send? And if this is the best they could come up with, let's send another group in to get it done the right way. I don't think, as much as a lot of people would like to see it go through, I don't think it's going to go through in lame duck. I just don't see that happening.
We will be watching it closely, as I know will you, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for your leadership on so many of these issues and for joining us from time to time to talk about them. We look forward to doing so again in the very near future. In the meantime, of course, keep up the good work. Adam Credo joins us. We'll talk about Huma Abedin's family tree and what it might tell us about her role in the Clinton administration. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time in an altogether too long a time by Adam Credo, a terrific investigative reporter with a most important outlet these days, Washington Free Beacon. You can follow his writings at freebeacon.com. Adam is the author of an important piece about, the family tree, I guess is the way I think of it, of important and largely unappreciated figure in Hillary Clinton's world and indeed in the United States government for quite some time, Huma Abedin. He published a piece on this subject of, her father and his Islamic supremacist inclinations. Yesterday at the Free Beacon, it was picked up and amplified a bit at the Daily Mail today. Adam, congratulations on this important bit of research, and thank you for sharing some time with us to discuss it.
Always my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
So you tumbled upon unnoted interview that Huma Abedin's father, Dr. Saeed Abedin, gave several decades ago, I guess now. Tell us a little bit about what he said and what it suggests about at least his own thinking on this issue of the Islamic supremacist agenda.
Sure. Well, this is video that was recorded in 1971. It was a panel interview with him and two other individuals, and it was broadcast, as far as I know, only on Western Michigan University Television. So
a small audience.
Yeah, incredibly so. And we stumbled across it in the archives, and going through it, found it very fascinating because you really got a window, and I wrote this in the piece, into the mindset of the family leader, who was, until his death in 93, relatively reclusive. We didn't know a lot about him, so it was fascinating to see this. And this is a discussion, essentially, how he sees Sharia law evolving in the modern Islamic world, how he sees the state playing a role in imposing and policing the enforcement of Sharia and things along these lines. One of the more fascinating things I'll note just quickly is his take on how the Western world and its, as he puts it, infiltration into the Muslim world has created hostility among Muslims.
This, of course, is sort of the meme that we've heard a lot out of this community, that Muslims are victims. It lends itself to sort of the central purpose of the Institute on Muslim Minority Affairs that Saeed Abedin founded with his wife, Salia. Talk, if you would, a little bit about this other, the larger family footprint in this space, Adam Credo. His wife, we're told, has long been a leading figure in the Muslim sisterhood. The brother of Huma Abedin in the brotherhood, I guess, his sister also involved in this family business. What is the sort of takeaway as you see it? Is it likely that Huma Abedin may have some of these sentiments as well?
Well, look, it's hard to know what somebody believes unless they tell you directly, but I would say that the footprint of the family provides an interesting type of insight because they're very dedicated to this. This isn't just a group of people who uphold their faith at home. They're actively promoting, they're actively establishing organizations. The father, Saeed, I believe, moved them to Saudi Arabia for a time, and he was well-connected with the Saudi Arabian government. So I think that it's worth highlighting this as we look at somebody who could potentially be a chief of staff in a White House, a very senior individual in the Clinton administration.
The business of Institute on Muslim Minority Affairs is best captured, I guess, by this Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs. And Huma has been associated with that, I think, for some 12 years. So, again, this does raise a serious question as to her proclivities. And, Adam, if you look at those proclivities, of course, as you know, there was an effort made several years ago, 2012, as I recall, by Michelle Bachmann and four other members of Congress to ask the Inspector General of the State Department to look into whether Huma's involvement with these rather unsavory Islamist operations might have had some bearing on the policies adopted during Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. And you've covered these issues so well at the Washington Free Beacon for so long, the Iran deal and you know, the Muslim Brotherhood role and on and on. What are your thoughts on that question, which never really did get a satisfactory answer from the IG?
No, it certainly didn't. And, you know, one of the things I find truly fascinating here is that Huma has emerged as such a prominent figure in Clinton world. But when have we seen an interview with her? When have we seen somebody actually ask her about her worldview, her ideologies, her her thoughts on these types of subjects. You don't see it. And I find that somewhat troubling on the level that how can we know about the leaders of our government and what they might be doing when they're put in places of power without this type of thing? There should be at least some level of transparency and sunlight, I think, on this end of things, especially with her track record. Look, you also mentioned her time at the family magazine, also in college, as far as I recall, a prominent member of the MSA sat on the board of that organization.
It is a great question, Adam, and I wonder how that could be. There have been a number of profiles of her, including a pretty fatuous one by the Washington Post a few years back, in which she was described as, you know, Hillary Clinton's most important advisor on matters involving the Middle East. It seems in the intervening period, she's become pretty influential on everything. But why do you think it is that we've not seen her interviewed and really pressed to explain whether she associates with her family's views on Islamic supremacy?
You know, I really don't know, and I find it strange because very often these people who play these roles in other administrations, other campaigns, other offices of lawmakers, they're out there. People have access to them. For some reason, there's no access to whom, and I can't describe it any other way but strange.
Well, you know, you say nobody's interviewed her. I guess the FBI has interviewed her in connection with this email scandal. And there's been a number of things that have come out in those emails. And, Adam, one that I know you followed closely was Ben Rhodes' efforts to spin the Benghazi saga and sending Huma Abedin and Rashad Hussein out to explain to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation that it was this dastardly video that was responsible, and we were going to be seeing more evidence of efforts to crack down on such things. Again, strikingly, I think, compromising in terms of this whole issue of what kind of influence is she exercising.
Yeah, I think you're right, especially with that, the effort to kind of soothe this and put out a false explanation in order to I don't know what column the Muslim community. I'm not entirely certain what Ben Rhodes was thinking there. But look, this is also the same guy that spun the media on the Iran deal and really welcomed into the fold a whole host of organizations from NIAC, the National Iranian American Council, which has been seen as a lobbying shop for Tehran, to other similar groups. So,
right, the famous echo chamber, and I would just say to you, I think that the role was Huma Abedin and certainly Hillary Clinton had been actively cultivating with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation this idea of suppressing speech that that blasphemed or offended Islam. So, Adam, we are so grateful to you for your reporting on all of these subjects. We look forward to visiting with you about them again in the very near future. Thanks for taking some time to talk about your important piece about Huma Abedin's dad yesterday in the Washington Free Beacon. See it, please, at freebeacon.com. Adam, we'll talk with you again soon. My colleague Fred Flights joins us next. We'll talk about some of that stuff, Iran and otherwise. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights. These days, he is a senior vice president for the Center for Security Policy with responsibility for policies and programs. He is a man with an extraordinarily interesting and valuable background in intelligence, specifically as a CIA analyst for some 20 years as a chief of staff to John Bolton during his time at the State Department and as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of an important new book about Obamabomb, the national security fraud involved in the Iran deal. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, as always.
Good to be here, Frank.
Hey, listen, I've been talking throughout the program about this internet giveaway, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, Fred, as an intelligence professional. I've just learned that several attorneys general have sued in federal court trying to stop this, and I'm hoping that they will be found to have standing and succeed. But what are your thoughts on the nature of this undertaking?
Well, two things. This shows the lawlessness of the Obama administration. It's pretty clear there's large bipartisan majorities in each House of Congress not to do this. The president's been told not to do it, but the president doesn't care what the legislative branch thinks. So the next question is, building off of what your other guest said, why is Mr. Obama doing this? And I think the reason is that Mr. Obama is a far-left internationalist. And he really believes in a radical view of global government and basically subordinating our country to international organizations and the United Nations. And given the history of these organizations of being dominated by anti-American and totalitarian forces, I think this is a very dangerous precedent.
It is, and I'm afraid that it will have far-reaching implications, quite apart from the precedent, for our own use of the Internet, its service as an instrument of free expression and entrepreneurialism to the benefit of its enemies. Anyway, Fred, we'll be following that closely, as I know will you. Let me turn to Russia with you. There have, of course, been some important developments of late. I'd like to get your thoughts in particular on the opposition that the Joint Chiefs of Staff expressed in the person of the chairman last week about sharing intelligence with the Russians as part of a ceasefire deal that has come a cropper, not surprisingly, negotiated by the guy who negotiated that Obama bomb fiasco, John Kerry. Talk about that, if you would, and more broadly, what Russia is up to as you see it in Syria and Iraq.
This is an important issue that's not getting much press coverage. The New York Times ran an editorial on September 29th entitled Vladimir Putin's Outlaw State, lamenting how we keep making these deals with Russia and they keep stabbing us in the back. And I'm thinking about Syria. John Kerry negotiated an agreement with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov for a peace deal, a ceasefire in Syria, which would have involved the U.S. sharing intelligence with Russia and cooperating on attacking terrorists. This was 2 weeks ago. The Russians, the Iranians, and the Syrians ignored the ceasefire deal and decided to double down on destroying the city of Aleppo, including Russia firing dropping bunker buster bombs and incendiary bombs. And the Obama administration is basically clueless. Kerry wants to respond by stop talking to Russia. So what we have to think about here is we see Donald Trump being criticized for his approach to Russia, but we have Kerry, on one hand, promoting sanctions against Russia for what it did in Ukraine, and on the other hand, cooperating with Russia on the terrible Iran deal in Syria. The Russians are laughing at us. They've basically eaten our lunch. We have no policy or credibility whatsoever in the world, particularly concerning Russia.
Hey, Fred, let me turn to a different topic with you. I know we spoke last week about Edward Snowden. You wrote a very strong and, I think, quite well-articulated and justified piece about the fact that he is a traitor and a fraud. You've now had a chance, as I understand it, to see the movie that Oliver Stone has made, promoting a very different characterization of this man. Tell us about your takeaway from the movie.
Well, Frank, I took one for the team by going to see this terrible travesty of a movie, Snowden, produced by Oliver Stone. And Snowden is portrayed as this saint who stood up against these evil government agencies who were systematically abusing our rights. And there are just so many inaccuracies about his case. It doesn't mention the fact that he was a disgruntled employee who was fired by the CIA. Actually, the movie says he left the CIA because of ethical objections to a covert operation in Switzerland of trying to blackmail a Pakistani diplomat That didn't happen. He was fired because he tried to break into computer systems in Geneva, which I understand involved in changing his personnel valuation. It doesn't mention that he stole the passwords of about a dozen, maybe more, NSA employees so he could steal more classified information. What happened to those people? Those colleagues, they all lost their jobs. I mean, it's just one lie after another to portray this guy as a saint and misrepresenting what exactly was going on with these intelligence programs, very few of which he actually understood.
Fred, we appreciate you, as you say, taking one for the team to go see this travesty, but it's important that you continue your very, very important truth-telling about what has gone on here and in so many other instances involving the security interests of the United States. Speaking of which, let me ask you about the latest developments on the Clinton email scandal. We had the FBI director, James Comey, up before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. I know a number of members took him to task, particularly our friend Louis Gohmert of Texas. Give us a sense of what is coming to light now and what we're learning most especially about an institution that we've relied upon to safeguard us against such criminal activity by the Clintons and others.
Well, God bless Louis Gohmert. What he said in the hearing was exactly what we need to know about the secret email server. Clinton wanted a secret email server to keep her emails off the government systems so Louis Gohmert couldn't see her emails. That's what this is about, to evade federal record laws that make the official communications of a high official a record, an official record that has to be held accountable and archived. She didn't want to do that. She didn't want Congress to see what she was doing. And I think a principal reason for this is that so much of what she was doing was concerning the Clinton Foundation and illegal efforts to enrich herself and her husband, not just with contributions from billionaire contributors to the Clinton Foundation, but from foreign countries like Saudi Arabia. Gohmert said that's what she wanted to hide from the American people and from me, and he's absolutely right.
You have to worry that not only was she concealing from us information that she didn't want us to have, but she was making available to others information that we don't want them to have. And I'm thinking about any number of foreign governments and perhaps others, just even non-state actors and hackers and the like. Give us a net assessment, Fred, based on what we've learned to date, both from Comey and others, about the impact of all of this.
From a State Department Inspector General report, we know that there were attempts to hack Clinton's email server and that these instances were not reported to state security. The FBI report on Clinton says the same thing, but even more important, that Comey said in his statement in July that although we don't have evidence that foreign hackers broke into her cell phone and communications when she traveled abroad, it's very likely that this happened because they wouldn't leave evidence behind. We know from the State Department IG report she used an iPhone and an iPad, even though she was told not to, when traveling to nations where there is a severe risk of being hacked by foreign countries who are hostile to the United States. I think they stole substantial amounts of U.S. secrets because of Clinton's refusal to follow communications rules and procedures.
Fred, I'm afraid we will be learning over the years about the full effects of what she's performed here, perpetrated, I should say. Fred, thank you very much for your time. As always, it's good to have a chance to talk with you. We look forward to doing so again next week, and we look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.